Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And we are here together. Dennis can't join us tonight, but no worries. Zach, our new... I would do a drum roll, but my camera will bounce all over the place. Jeff, give us a drum roll. Our new official What's the Scuttlebutt podcast producer, Mr. Zach Morris. He will do all the production producer type things in the background, plus be up to speed on our episode content for that week in case, like this week, someone says, hey, I can't make it. Boom, Zach steps in, fills the void. We continue on like nothing ever happened. You guys will never be the wiser with the exception of me pointing out today, but we wanted to announce that Zach is now the official What's the Scuttlebutt podcast producer. We've needed one for years, and here we are. We're moving up in the world. It only took a short 7-some-odd years, but hey, we're getting there, ladies and gentlemen. We thought, you know, change up a little bit this week. 4th of July is coming up Friday. It's big for us here in the United States, but there's a lot going on in the 40s around 4th of July, and so we figured... let's talk about some of the context and content of the past and some of the wars, big and small campaigns that you may not have been on your radar that happened right around the time that we would have been celebrating independence, which that's kind of a fun thought exercise, gentlemen. How do you... obviously, we've experienced that during modern day war times, right? Gulf War, Desert Storm, Iraqi Freedom, Vietnam. Well, we weren't there for Vietnam, but... I think it's fair to say that patriotism was treated a different way in the 40s. Could you imagine what it was like during those 4-some-odd years that we were actively involved in the war? What it would have been like to celebrate 4th of July and Independence Day and the patriotism while the war of that magnitude was going on?
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point. That's definitely one I've never really thought about before. But
yeah, because we've discussed Christmas. We've discussed... Thanksgiving, but I don't think we've really thought about 4th of July.
No, and, you know, it makes me think, were they big celebrations, or were they a little more reserved because all of our resources are somewhere else and probably being better used? So that's interesting. I imagine people would put their buntings and their flags out, and I'm sure, you know, local organizations would probably have some type of a parade and, you know, maybe even some World War One veterans marching through Main Street. But I don't know. I don't think it's probably anything like what we do today.
Well, and if you think about it, too, the distance from that date to that time was shorter. And as you were just alluding to, World War One vets, some of their great-grandfathers, you have direct descendants of people who, like, it was only one or two generations away that family members were actively involved in that situation in those wars. And so it was a lot closer to home. Obviously, the further we get away from things, the more generations you get away from things, the less impact things have on people. But you're closer. You got this big war thing going on. But to Jeff's point, every housewife... they're making things stretch, right? You got the ration stamps, shortages on everything. You want to celebrate, but then you got to ask, okay, well, we want to get together with the neighbors. Clearly, we're going to have a potluck, right? But even in a potluck, you're basically going to take away from your family's food supply for that week to celebrate that one night. But you may say it's worth it. So it's an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah, it really isn't. It really is an interesting question. I ask myself that question all the time, Don. It's like, what must that have been like? Even July 4th aside, you know, just what it must have been like to live in a time, especially in this country, where like everybody was united. Everybody had the same goal. You know, everybody was on the same page, and like especially, you know, dial that up for 4th of July, a holiday like that. You know, it really is interesting to have felt what that felt like to live in that time, you know, what that must have felt like.
And it's a smaller world, right? Back then, more larger farm communities, small, less people lived in the big cities. So maybe you had extra supplies because you're a farmer. But with that being said, the world was smaller. Obviously, they didn't have the internet. The biggest thing they had for media was newspaper and radio. And so this was probably one of those few times a year where in these smaller farming communities, you put down, you know, you take a day off and get together with your neighbors. And so once again, it may have been worth the expenditure of – supplies to, because that could possibly be 6 or 7 days a year that your hardworking family can take off and commune with the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so,
well, I can tell you, I've got an interesting story from the 4th of July, 2004.
Okay.
And I'll make it short here, but
no, take your time.
You know, that was about halfway through my deployment. So there was a lottery for furlough to come home for 10 days. And the number I picked was probably not going to come home at the time. But my driver and best friend, from the Army had swapped numbers with me. I think I drew like 20 something. And 1 through 20 was guaranteed, and then like 21 to 35 was like iffy, and then if it was over 36, whatever, you're probably not going to get one. So didn't think my number was going to go. He pulls a number 2, and he gives it to me. And because, Tammy and I weren't married yet, but we were engaged, and, she had joined the Army. She was in basic training. She breaks her foot. They're holding her over at PTRP. So it had been about 7 months, and I hadn't seen her before I deployed. So I get to Kuwait March of 04, and she comes home like the very beginning of April. Like, we missed each other by that much. And then I start my year-long deployment. So my boy Chuck said, "Here, dude, you're going home. Like, you got to see Tammy. We just got started here, you know, and you haven't seen her in almost a year." And this guy had a wife and 2 kids at the time. So it really meant a lot.
Well, that was going to be my question. So that was kind of going to be my question. No. Did he give you his number as a favor, or was he one of these poor individuals who didn't have a close family to go home to? But you just answered that question. So that means even more.
Oh, yeah.
No. Yeah. It was just, that's how we were. It was just that tight. And, so coming home was the worst thing ever. It was like the worst possible idea in the history of ideas for then, for the Army to send you home for 10 days in the middle of that nonsense was ludicrous. But it was during 4th of July. And, the feelings I had then are totally different than what I have now. But it was like I looked around, and I think about this in context with World War II. Let's say you've got a guy who's wounded. He comes home. He finally gets home. Maybe he's there for 4th of July, but Guadalcanal or France or the skies over Europe are still pretty fresh for this guy. And he's seeing these people celebrating, and he's seeing these parades and, maybe some fireworks. And I know for me, I looked around and was like, God, you people have no freaking idea what's going on right now. And it made me angry. And it was just naive, right? People are not blatantly ignorant, but it was just the naivety of it, because they just simply didn't know what we were doing overseas. So to go from that environment, and then you're just shoved on a plane 24 hours later, you're just expected to just hang out with your family for 10 days and put on a pair of blue jeans again. Very difficult. So, those are kind of the things I think about, because I pull from a lot of my personal experiences. Like, did some of those guys have those same thoughts coming home at any time?
Sure.
But maybe 4th of July or maybe Thanksgiving or Christmas, and you're like, geez, Mom, you're worried about the freaking chickens and we got to rebuild the coop. But God, you've got no clue what it's like to throw a track off of a Sherman in the hedgerow country. Like, what are you complaining about? Right?
Well, and to your point, I think we kind of got a little bit of a glimpse of that with John Bazelon's feeling, right? Because he wasn't sent home for 4th of July. He was sent home on a war bond tour. And as much fun as he had, after a while, his conscience got to him. Like, I'm here dating starlets and getting the Hollywood treatment, but my boys are training and going over, or some of them are still over there fighting. And so he did what he did, I guess, to, maybe sleep better at night. And that he just had a love for the organization. We know, with his history in the Army and in the Marine Corps. But yeah, I think we got a slight bit of a glimpse in that. But to your point about coming home during those times, the civilian side of that is, obviously, we all kind of get complacent. We're going on with our lives. But we got to remember, at that time, that was the slogan. Remember, don't let the terrorists win. Go to work. keep on living your life, got to keep the economy winning, or that was the catchphrase they wore, or the terrorists will win. This is what they wanted. So that was kind of the propaganda towards the citizens at that time, while you guys are there serving. It was keep on living your life, keep on going about, and when you get home, turn on CNN and Fox News. Well, I don't even think Fox is around then, so turn on CNN and the four major news channels and get caught up on the war, but other than that, get back to work. And so I can definitely see how you guys were frustrated and like, what the hell, you know, we're over here fighting, you guys are just chilling here like nothing's going on. But it was almost like that was part of the overall plan as far as the government and keeping the economy going.
Jeff, that's so interesting that you bring up that story, that's how you felt, you know, in 2004, because, you know, you mentioned like it kind of like made you angry that like seeing that like in the like being on the home front, because I just finished the chapter. I started reading John Bruning's 53 Days on Starvation Island. And right away in the first few chapters of the book, they're talking about how the guys on Guadalcanal, like kind of how Don mentioned Barcelona, they all came home, you know, for like a war bond tour, those pilots on Guadalcanal. And, you know, one of the characters, Marion Carl and John L. Smith, they're sitting there in like an Army-Navy game or like an Army game, or I think it was like Alabama versus something like that. And they're just sitting there, you know, they hadn't even been off Guadalcanal for like 3 weeks. And here they are in America stateside in a football stadium where it seemed like nobody was paying attention to what the guys were doing on Guadalcanal. They're just cheering. And, you know, these football players are getting in a fight on the field. And he's like, you're wasting this energy on each other, you know, that, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, that it's like you felt that in 04. It's like the same feeling that these guys had way back then. You know, 4th of July aside, they were bringing them home in like November, December of 42. And they were feeling that exact same way, too. It's just, you know, it's really interesting that you bring that up.
Not to go outside the realm of this particular campaign, but the very, you'll all remember, is in platoon. Remember, he's talking about how he went home and he's talking about how his language changed. Blanking A, Ma, hand over these potatoes are effing great, Ma. And he was talking about how he had been in the system for so long and he got that vernacular and he'd been in country for so long that when he got to go home, I think, I don't remember if it was a furlough or medical, but he got to go home for a brief period of time before getting sent back. And he was talking about, you know, it was weird to him. Everybody was just going about and here he is in that mood and how his mom was just completely caught off. But yeah, he was kind of explaining that same experience. So it's interesting, clearly, we have a separation, you know, Revolutionary War, Civil War, all the local war campaigns here that affects the home front very differently. But then once things move, World War II, World War I, Korean campaign, foreign global, once the home front is not actively involved, it's, you know, that's when those sort of feelings come up because they are not actively involved and people get complacent and don't have at the top of mind things that they're not actively involved with.
Yeah.
So we were looking at the calendar and all the different campaigns and events that happened around this general time during the span of World War II. And we figured we'd cover some of those and mention all of them. So I guess which one of you guys want to go first? I want to cover one at the end because I have a tendency to ramble. So I'll let you guys go and we'll start out. Maybe we'll start with Jeff and then go to Zach and then I'll bring up the rear.
Sure. So, yeah, like Don mentioned, in the spirit of the 249th birthday of America coming up this week, we wanted to kind of discuss some of the 4th of July dates that happened during World War II and some of those key campaigns and some of those wars within wars, like Don mentioned earlier. You know, listen, if this is your first time listening to What's the Scuttlebutt, number one, welcome. Number two, you've got a lot of catching up to do. And before I get into this, Don, we got to fix something. Zach needs a WTSP T-shirt.
Yes, I do.
This is bad.
I was going to say that. Like, I need more. I need more memorabilia and stuff.
We can definitely do that. For sure. And as a reminder, our audience need more WTSP content as well. And I have to say, we're not very good marketing people. That's one thing Zach's going to help us out with. We don't mention that we do have a merch store and head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on the merch link. I think the merch link, there's a banner on the top of our page. I think if you click the arrow, you'll see Jeff and his crew on the train. I believe that's the thumbnail for the merch link. Click on that. It'll take you to our store. You can get hats. You can get the shirt that Jeff has, his beloved coffee mug, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we will do, we'll extend the same courtesy to Zach that we extend to our top-level tier Patreon members. If you sign up for Patreon and you choose the top tier after month two, we will send you a message saying, hey, fella or lady, go to our merch store, pick out the t-shirt you want, tell us the size, the color, and which one you want, and your address, and we'll send one your way. So we'll do the same thing for Zach. And so, yeah, we have a big store. I think we're going to work on some. Jeff and I were talking about this the other day. We want to work on some new shirt prints, maybe incorporate the Army Air Corps and their logos or stylings. Who knows? Maybe we can come up with like a really cool WTSP kind of themed nose art shirt or something. We're going to come up with some aviation variant WTSP shirts. I think it's been, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years since we put out a new shirt. The last new shirt we have is the one Jeff has with the coffee guy. And so that one. But yeah, we will get Zach a shirt and the like, some stickers and what have you. But yeah, and to Jeff's point, we do have some new listeners. And so welcome everybody. And thanks for hanging out.
Yeah, all right. So for those of you who do know and have listened to this show, I'm huge on the Air War, the 8th Air Force, and their contribution to the war effort. I feel like it cannot be talked about enough. So I chose July 4th, 1943, and I got this from the 100th Bomb Group website, 100thBG.com. And this is an interesting time, July of 1943, within the 8th Air Force. Of course, as we know, this is still Ira Ayker's 8th Air Force, right? So the bombing campaign has been going on for about a year, and it's almost, in my opinion, it's almost criminal what some of these guys are being put through. The Strategic Daylight Bombing Campaign, that was really kind of the brainchild of General Anderson, if you will, General Orville Anderson, as he was kind of the strategic bombardment theorist. So we were still kind of hooked on the dropping those bombs down the pickle barrel, the manufacturing facilities, the marshalling yards, the submarine pens at this time. That was still the main objective. And as we know, history has shown now, it's a whole different 8th Air Force July of 1944, a year later. We've got P-51s. We've got Jimmy Doolittle at the helm, completely changing our tactics. So, but we're still on that, let's bomb military industrial targets of opportunity. So on this particular day, July 4th, 1943, the field order called for an attack on the submarine base at La Palisse near La Rochelle in the northwest coast of France. The mission order called for the maximum number of aircraft with long-range wingtip fuel tanks to fly, for the route flown was entirely over the water from the coast of England to landfall near Bordeaux, with low altitude maintained through the flight to escape detection by RDF. Now, at Thorpe Abbotts, where the 100th Bomb Group was stationed there, just a couple days before, they got a new commander. So, and if you've seen Masters of the Air, you probably know Colonel Hughlin. He was relieved, I believe, on the 2nd of July. You know, he had the severe stomach ulcers. So Colonel Hardin comes in, Chick Hardin, and, you know, the All-American, right? He was on the Army football team back in the mid-20s. This guy was a real game changer. So this is actually Colonel Harding's first mission in control of the 100th Bomb Group on the 4th of July, 1943. So again, it's kind of a transition time period. So 27-year-old Major John Egan would carry Brigadier General Anderson as a special observer in his fortress. General Anderson would be on his first combat mission over Europe. 31-year-old Robert Pearson was scheduled to fly the lead of the second element, and two of the new replacement crews who had just arrived at Thorpe Abbotts on June 26th would also be flying their first combat missions under their leadership of the 21-year-old Owen Roan and Henry Hennington, both pilot and co-pilot for that crew. Let's see. Loaded with 1,000-pound bombs, those flying with the other groups took off first in light fog, low visibility, because the 100th's main formation of B-17s followed. Off was without incident, although a haze caused some difficulty in assembling. So we have a little bit of a messy takeoff, but pretty much clear skies over the channel. Then things start to go awry. At the designated IP, the groups began their turn toward the target, but due to the large distance between the groups, confusion and converging courses also resulted at the IP and on the bombing run. During the climb to altitude, Robert Pearson's fortress experienced issues when his oil pressure ran dangerously low. Nursing his fortress along, he kept dropping lower and further behind the formation. His two wingmen followed him down until about 18,000 feet, but then they had to return to the formation. Observers said Pierce's bomb bay doors were open. His crew would recall that they their bombs were jettisoned in the water. And at about 5,000 feet, Pearson told his crew that he would try and reach that small island of Ile de Leron. As he would fly over the island with wheels down, the anti-aircraft gunners opened up on his B-17. Pearson's bombardier, John Dunbar, was hit. After Pearson rang the bailout bell, his waist gunner, Lonnie Rutledge, moved toward the escape hatch and fell through, but getting caught in the gears. Pulled free by the engineer, Jack Goss, they successfully bailed out before their B-17 crashed on the island. So all but Pearson's fortress would be counted in coming over Thorpe Abbott's. Major John Egan would be grateful to just return with a sleeve torn off of his shirt. During the mission, he saw his top turret gunner, John Shea's, dangling feet, which meant that his oxygen hose had become disconnected. Collapsed, Shea's head had caught between the turret and the gun sight, his hands still grasping the turret controls. Despite the fact that he was risking unconsciousness himself, Major Egan climbed into the narrow turret, replaced the gunner's oxygen supply, and narrowly missed death when the reviving man touched off the turret controls, setting the mechanism revolving. Both Major and Sergeant were sent spinning around, banging against the sides of the narrow passageway. By the time the pilot had stopped the whirring turret, the gunner had suffered a chipped fracture of the hip bone, and Major Egan was minus a sleeve. Major Egan was quoted as saying, quote, "I had visions of being ground up into one great meatball, but I'm going to miss that shirt. It was my Sunday best," end quote. Later on, Red Bowman would record in the 100th diary, quote, "The 4th of July, and we celebrated with a raid on La Palisse, France. It was one of the most successful to date, and the men who came back from the raid all agreed they had never had more fun on the 4th or set off bigger firecrackers."
Yeah, you don't get much bigger than that.
Now, wow. That is so, on so many levels, that tells us so much, right? This is coastal France. This is what's considered a milk run, mm-hmm. right? It's the 4th of July, and you're still dealing with fog. The assembly point was a little messy. Once they hit the IP, it's even messier because of the time between the bomb groups taking off. We saw that all the time. Right? Oh, yeah, this bomb group's going to take off 15 minutes after us, and then they get grounded for 2 hours, and then they send them anyway. You know, like I said, it's just those, to me, those criminal thoughts that Bomber Command had to just go ahead with stuff and send these boys over there. It bothers me.
Yeah.
And then you see, but then you also see that kind of, you know, almost an immature feeling, right? Like they're still just boys that come back and like, man, this is the best 4th of July we've ever had, bombing this submarine pen. But still, when we think of the heart of what the 8th Air Force was doing and what they were supposed to do, bombing these U-boat pens probably really wasn't any different than Doolittle's raid over Tokyo or Osaka, right?
Yeah.
What did it do? Oh, man, the enemy was like, wow, a lot of B-17s in the air, right? And just because we put maybe, let's say, the majority of those 1,000-pound bombs into that mean point of impact, oh, that makes us feel good. Did we destroy any of those submarine pens? Probably not. So, again, this is a year into the aerial campaign, and we're still doing some of the same stuff that we've been doing for a year, bombing these submarine pens, thinking that we're actually taking out German industry or bombing a marshalling yard that's back in operation 4 weeks later. And it really just has to make people think, and I'll end it with this, how is this relevant? How is this relevant today? Why care, right? I'm a history teacher. This is what we do. Why do we care about this? We just saw a week ago how a specific weapon carried by a specific aircraft strategically placed. Now we saw at the end of World War II, strategic bombing could end a war. We see today, strategic bombing can prevent one.
Yeah.
That's relevant. What these guys were doing, or not accomplishing, but what they were doing overall was setting the stage for things like Operation Midnight Hammer, for things like a bunker buster hanging off of a B-2 to do what they just did in Iran. That's what these guys, that's where this started. And this is where we learn all of the lessons, and we chewed up a lot of meat learning those lessons. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for those guys, hey, I mean, we all talk about Saving Private Ryan, right? We all talk about Band of Brothers, D-Day. Not a single German plane in the air, though. That's a big deal. Boots on the ground is not always our most valuable asset. We need those force multipliers. We need control of the skies.
Mm-hmm.
It's been proven in every campaign. And again, to think about today, like, how is this relevant today? But think about what we did with Midnight Hammer. Even just trying to keep it the element of surprise, right? The element of surprise itself can be the most dangerous weapon. It can flip the tables when you're outnumbered and outgunned. That's a force multiplier in itself. And for us to keep something like that secret for the most part in today's world.
That's what I was going to say. Now with social media and, you know, it's like, how do you keep troop movements and staging quiet? How do you,
right.
do you tell your troops you're sending them to X and you're really sending them to W? I mean, there's got to be a little subterfuge in order to keep things quiet, especially with how quickly stuff travels nowadays.
Absolutely.
And to Jeff's point, these sub pens, I just saw a video on YouTube, I think a week ago, modern day drone footage. Forgive me, don't know what city in Germany, but they're showing a sub pen today. The thing is so big, the concrete is so thick that even in 2025, no corporation could find enough value in this oceanfront property to spend.